when we're dealing with persons, we're not looking for merely short-term outcomes of a few data points on a test. When we're dealing with persons, we're asking, how is this person growing? How are they being brought up? As a teacher, I am more concerned about what a child's going to know 10 months from now and how he or she is going to be different 10 months from now. Will he be more mature? Will he relate in his relationship to history, in his relationship to math, in his relationship to his classmates? Will she have more friends throughout the ages? Will she have more friends in creation? More animals that she knows, birds she can recognize, insects that she can identify and know something about them? Will she be more curious at the end of the year than she was at the start of the year? How will she be relating with herself and with work? Will she be more diligent at the end of the year than she was at the beginning of the year? Will she be more peacefully on task? These are the kinds of concerns we have for our children when we view them as persons. When we're just concerned what the test grade will be, well, that's a very reduced view. So we ask the question, if children are persons, how are we going to teach? How will it be different in our classes, in our homes? If we see children as not demigods, not having everything they, in a sense, not needing us, or if we see them as products to be molded by us, what's going to be different? And Charlotte Mason lays out three tools that we can use. She says, if we're going to treat children as persons, there are a whole lot of things we can't do. Principally, we can't manipulate them. We can't make it about our little worksheets. We can't make it about just getting the grades on the tests. We can't even use our personalities to try to manage them to perform for us. They're not to be trained SEALs. They're persons. So what three tools do we have? The first tool we have is the atmosphere that we set. This is the air that's going to be breathed in. This is the culture. And how children themselves live will be hugely determined by the culture, the atmosphere that they have inhaled from around them. The second tool we have is the power of habit, the intentional formation of habits. Do you know that everything we learn is inscribed in the neural network in our brain, that when I learn something new, I actually get a new brain? And once I've learned something, it's much easier to go down the learned neural pathway than it is to create a new one. Well, this is a very helpful tool. Most of us live most of the time out of the habits that we formed. Teachers can be very intentional about the formation of habit. Such things as the habit of attention, the habit of neat and careful work, the habit of kindness to others, the habit of doing work punctually, the habit of careful and accurate thought, the habit of asking good questions. All of these, you can think of them as brain skills that are learned. And we can be very intentional. It's a very powerful tool. The third tool we have is the power of ideas themselves. That an inspirational idea can catch a heart, motivate a heart, and form a mind. You say, what is it that adheres to our mind? Well, ideas do. Some of us are more gifted in terms of putting things in short-term memory, but the things that will stay with us 6 months, 8 months from now are the ideas that have captured us head and heart. And so great texts that actually engage our ways of seeing, to have a new idea is to have a new way of seeing things. And once I have that new way of seeing things, much can unfold from it. So these are the three tools. Education as an atmosphere, education as the discipline, the intentional formation of habit, and education as the engagement of living ideas. Given these three tools, we can create an optimal education for children without using standard manipulative tools, without using shame, praise, teacher personality, without using grades as a motivational factor. One of the wonderful things about this place is you'll never hear a child ask the question, do I need to know that for the test? How much do I have to know to get an A? Those kinds of questions don't appear. The only relevant question is, how much do you know? What do you know? And what more can you know?
In speaking about the sacredness of a child's personality, often as well-intended adults, we come into the child's life and we begin to think that it's our duty to affirm and give the child esteem and give him his self-esteem. And so we use ways of communicating about his work or his looks or his behavior in such a way that it actually takes away his self-esteem. And so let me give you some example of that. One of the ways in which especially teachers do this is that we begin to affirm people and find the one good thing that they do. And, you know, we offer accolades for that, sometimes through ribbons, sometimes through prize, but often just through praise. Good job. Oh, you're great at that. That's your gift. That's your talent. And, you know, it's affirming in some ways. But then they're always kind of looking to us for that affirmation. And so often when people come to see the relationship of Charlotte Mason with children, and specifically with our work at Ambleside, they take notice that there are many good things happening in the classroom as they observe, and they take note that the teacher's remarkably silent, that a child will just give a brilliant narration, and another student will do wonderful work in something, and that the attention is not on the student, but on the work. And so a question might be given to the student to think about, what made this work good? How do you know that you've met the characteristics of a good composition? And so the responsibility's back on the student. And so that the child now has tools within his own mind and within his own relationship to himself in which he can evaluate and which he can give critique to his work and his way of relating to subjects. And we all know as adults when we've done something well. I mean, when I've spoken well or when I've taught a class that's been particularly communicated in a way in which we really got at the ideas and I wasn't too much with the children, I've walked down the steps before. I've walked out the classroom door thinking, we really connected. That was very genuine. It was a class that was really worthy of the time well spent. And so I know that. There's no orientation toward a prize, or there's no desire for, you know, someone to come and tell me job well done. There's the deep satisfying relationship one has from working well, and we want to give that to our students. But one might argue and say, if you don't give it to them when they're young, they're never going to know that they can have that when they're older. Oh yes, they can. I often think of a time in which I've had students tell back, whether it's in a chapel experience or whether it's in the individual classroom, and the students have worked well. They've narrated well. They've assimilated the ideas. They've responded in wonderful questions and in wonderful relationships to the text. And we've had this engaging toss of them having the information and then bouncing and pinging back an idea and with the teacher and with other students and with the author themselves. And they've experienced that. And that itself was satisfying, and they always come back for more. They're eager to raise their hand, to participate in an active way, and not just be made silent. And so their behavior tells me that they've enjoyed the work of learning. They've enjoyed the work of relating to the text without having to be affirmed. And they are esteemed in and of themselves. They have self-esteem because they've worked well, not because a teacher in third grade said, good job, not because they've received a badge of honor when they were in fifth grade at a fair. They are esteemed because they've known how to work well.